Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here tonight. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off all your cell phones and other noise-making devices. Now, here are some of our upcoming Health and Medicine Forum events. On March, well, we have one on the 27th, but on restructuring healthcare, but that one has been sold out as of, I think, today or maybe yesterday. But the next one we have is March 20th, and it's how environmental factors induce autoimmune disorders. That sounds interesting. It's a noon program. And then on April 22nd, and I think this particular title might be full of all sorts of puns, but you can tell me. Big Weed, an Entrepreneur's High Stakes Adventures in the Budding Legend Legal of Marijuana Industry. Right? Yeah, okay. These are just a few of the upcoming programs, and I invite you to pick a copy of the Commonwealth publication in the lobby or check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. Questions will be asked by members of the audience using the microphone in the audience when JD's done his presentation. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. And now I'll begin today's program. Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's now my pleasure to introduce J.D. Griffin. J.D. has MBA, Certified Nutrition Coach, Men's Physique Competitor, and Financial Markets Professional. He is also author of the book that's available in the lobby for J.D. to sign at the end of the program. It's Get Fit, Lean, and Keep Your Day Job. J.D. wants you to teach you tonight how to get yourself into the best shape of your life by breaking health and fitness down to their essentials. Griffin has developed a functional approach with three sections: nutrition, cardiovascular exercise, and resistance training. He offers you a time-efficient, practical guide that he says anyone can follow and start seeing and feeling the results. So, JD, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Patty James. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me here this evening, and thank you to all the members and guests for coming, buying tickets, and showing up. I would like to start by telling you my agenda for the next 50 minutes. I'm going to talk about my message, the global obesity epidemic. I'm going to entertain you with my story. I'm going to talk about nutrition and fitness from an evolutionary lens, define exactly what a calorie is, calorie tracking apps and devices, and then I'm going to talk about the program itself, the Get Fit Lean program, which is three components. I'm going to talk about them in the reverse order of the book because nutrition is the most important, so that's going to be last. So I'm going to talk about weight training, cardio exercise, and nutrition. So my message is pretty simple and straightforward. There's no magic pill, there's no gimmick, there's no easy solution. If you commit to the plan, put in the work, you can get results. Anybody can get results. And that's the real message. Anybody can do it. Anybody can shed fat and develop lean muscle. My guide is a practical guide, reasonable, fits into a busy lifestyle, optimizes your time spent and your effort in the gym. The Get Fit Lean part refers to losing fat and replacing it with lean muscle. And Keep Your Day Job refers to the time efficiency, getting the most out of your workouts. Benefits are some quite obvious: aesthetics, appearance, call it vanity, look and feel better, lifts your self-esteem, your self-confidence, and then overall health and well-being. Improve your cardiovascular and respiratory system, lower your risk of illness. and slow the aging process. We can't, of course, stop it, but we can certainly slow it down and slow muscle and bone loss. My program also has proven results. You put in the work and you will get results. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the global obesity epidemic. Why is this happening? There's been a real shift in global food production just in the past couple of generations. There's more refined carbohydrates produced than ever before. It's convenient, packaged food, more processed food, manufactured oils and fats. Large shift in global food production. So unfortunately, the typical calories that are available to people are the wrong things we should be eating. They're cheaper to produce. There's greater margin of profit for producers, easy to distribute, warehouse, longer shelf lives. So we're really overwhelmed with bad food choices. The good food choices require a lot of effort and planning and aren't readily available oftentimes. There's loads of slides you can find like this. I wanted to put together a few just to show you that two-thirds of the calories that the average American consumes is from refined carbohydrates and processed foods. This is a distribution of self-reported obesity. California is not doing so bad, but it's still, keep in mind, this is just obesity. It's near 20%. You see here that two-thirds of the population is either overweight or obese, and just one-third of the people report healthy weight. So, obviously, there's a problem. The most common New Year's resolution is, I'm going to get fit, I'm going to lose weight, and get into shape. So it's on people's consciousness. Everybody thinks about it. Most of us would like to drop a couple of pounds of fat. But keep in mind, weight loss and fat loss are really two different things, and I like to distinguish the two because it's really in polite society will say things like, I want to lose weight, or your doctor will tell you ought to lose weight. The Jenny Craig program is called the weight loss program. It's not called the fat loss program. But really what we're talking about is losing fat, not losing weight. Weight is measured by the scale, but the mirror tells the real story. It's what you look like. So my program is about changing your body composition. The scale weight is less important. What really matters is that you're losing fat and you're developing lean muscle. So my program is really about reshaping your body composition. My program is not a diet. In fact, I just really try my best not to ever use the word diet. It's a nutrition plan, but better yet, it's a lifestyle. Diets fail. Most diets fail. Most people that go on a diet rebound, and a year later, they're back to their normal weight. Well, why is that? It's because diets really imply a temporary fix or a short-term solution. They're not practical, sustainable, and they're not something you can carry over for a lifetime. Most people will adopt some kind of strict eating regimen, and maybe they'll achieve their goals in a few months, and then a year later, it's all back on. Once the diet expires, they return to their so-called normal eating habits. So really, it's thinking of food in a different way. It becomes, it's fuel, it's energy, and it becomes a lifestyle. It's not a diet. It's a practical nutrition plan for a lifetime. It needs to be sustainable over a course of a lifetime. So it's about learning healthy food alternatives. Next, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story and how I came to write the book, the inspiration for the book, and a little bit of the story of the book. I first began lifting weights. I was 15 years old in my parents' basement with the plastic sand-filled weights that we got at Kmart in a narrow little bench and didn't have a clue what I was doing. And that was really age 15. My brother and I fooled around, read Arnold's books and Franco Colombo, and we thought we wanted to be big bodybuilders. When I got into college, by chance, I was in the same dorm as the football team, and I befriended a lot of the football players. They all had access to steroids. And I spent 4 years of college experimenting with steroids. The funny thing is, again, we didn't have a great idea about what we were doing. We just wanted to, we always used the phrase, big as a house. Everybody, guys, young guys, and I don't know if they still use it, But you want to be big as a house. So, you know, we bench pressed 3 times a week, and we just ate as much as we could, and we got big as a house. We got big, round, smooth, water-filled, bloated muscles, and thought we looked great. And I'd look at those pictures, and we didn't look so good. So that was the university years. When I graduated from school, I moved to Chicago, and I got a job in the financial markets, but I needed some extra money, so I got a job as a bouncer in a nightclub. And I think the management was very surprised when, 3 months later, after not having enough money for a gym membership or the time working 2 jobs, and I just stopped working out cold turkey, no more steroids. I lost 30 pounds over the course of that summer, and they're like, who is this skinny kid we hired to watch the front door? It's not really working. So it was then I really, and I ended up getting a full-time job. I didn't need the second job anymore. And I started working out regularly, and I said to myself then, I'm going to do this all completely natural. And I'm proud to say, and some of the slides you'll see later, I've never touched any kind of performance-enhancing drug. Everything I developed has been just through good nutrition and hard work. So you fast forward to middle years, 25 years later. I had been working in the financial markets. I was living in Houston, Texas. I worked for an investment bank, and I was really living the good life. Excessive dinners, lots of wine, no control, out in some of the best restaurants. And I gained quite a lot of weight, expanded waistline, and I was embarrassed to go to the beach. My self-esteem and self-confidence about my physical appearance was really at an all-time low. And I think the turning point for me came in the fall of 2008. The bank and myself were part of the financial crisis. Lost my job with investment bank. I was in a failing marriage, and I also had a physical done and had some invasive tests and medical scares. And I really thought things were going south pretty fast. It turns out the medical scares was some bad diagnostics, and I was okay. I got a job in California, and I was on my way out here. I decided this is my opportunity to really make a new change and a fresh start. So I started looking around. I knew that there's these 12-week body transformation contests, and there's several of them. They still go on today. And I found one, and I entered it, and my goal was really to win. I gave it everything. And I started looking around, looking for some kind of program. And there's books out there about how to win at a transformation contest. And I read a few, and there wasn't anything that stood out to me, and nothing too unusual. And I thought, you know what? I've spent, you know, at this point in my life, I was nearly 45 years old, and I'd read every popular nutrition diet book. I'd worked out with many trainers and pro athletes, and I've spent 25 years in the gym and doing this and experimenting on myself and trying diet plans, nutrition plans. I'm just going to sort of develop my own best of program, pull all the knowledge that I knew and try it on myself. So I implemented my own program. I kept track of everything. I was very serious about it, and I developed my Get Fit Lean program. I lost 35 pounds of fat in 12 weeks. I gained 5 pounds of muscle. And I did pretty good. I posted these pictures on Facebook, and I got an overwhelming response from mostly friends, but some people I didn't even know. And people started asking me what program I did. And I said, well, my own. So I began writing things down, and it started with just like a 3-page Word document of my nutrition plan, simple meal plan, and my workout routine. And I started sending it to friends, and the most interesting thing is the first person to try it, to try my program, I didn't even know what was going on. I'm not going to tell you this story because you have to read it in the book. I can't spoil everything. But it's a fantastic story. But the guy got incredible results. So over the course of, I spent about 5 years working on this book. But I'm going to tell you a better story, or just as good a story that's actually not in the book. It was about, I'm getting ahead of myself. So in the course of writing the book, maybe 3 years into the book, I discovered men's physique competitions. And I thought, this is a perfect opportunity for a proof of concept. I've done this, and I think I can do better. And I went with my girlfriend to a bodybuilding show. I hadn't been to one in 25 years, and they had this new category, men's physique. And I saw the guys on stage, and I'm like, I can do that. So I thought, you know, I'm in the middle of writing a book about fat loss and muscle development, so I'll really put this to the test. And I entered over the course of a couple of years, I entered five different physique contests. And I did pretty good. I actually placed and got trophies in younger age categories, and it was a lot of fun. And but the real benefit of this was I learned a lot. When you take yourself to 6% body fat, you learn a lot about how to lose fat. And it was great information to transfer. Well, even if for someone who's most of you and most people will never take it to this sort of extreme. But I learned a lot of valuable tips about how, in fact, you can lose fat and develop lean muscle just with good eating and the right exercise routine. The next story that I almost stole out of place was finding an editor. So I'd been working on my book. I had a lot of material over the course of 5 years. And there's, by chance, a mutual friend, and actually a childhood friend told me about another childhood friend who was an editor. The person lived in Chicago, a guy I'd been out of touch with most of my life. Our parents were friends at the same church, and I knew him. We crawled around in diapers together as babies, and I hadn't seen the guy in probably 30 years. So I reached out to him. His name's Steve Welch. And I told him about my manuscript. I spent all this time. I had a whole lot of material down, but it wasn't organized and wasn't as professional as it could actually be. And I asked him if he would take a look at it for me. And it turns out Steve's 1 year older than me, and he was approaching. He was maybe 4 months away from his 50th birthday. And like me, he'd sort of let himself go. And he was still a gym regular, but he was not concerned at all about his waistline and he had some weight to lose. And he thought, this is perfect for me because I'd really like to do something about my current condition and get into the best shape of my life for my 50th birthday. So he agreed to edit the book, and hence, and it's very professionally done now, thanks to Steve. But at the same time, as he was editing it, he actually followed the program. And I would say in percentage terms, because the guy's starting weight, he's a little shorter than me, he lost 35 pounds. But in percentage terms, I mean, he got down to like 150. I think in percentage terms, he did better than I did. And hats off to Steve. And this is the after pictures on his 50th birthday. So he did an amazing job. So we both realized we're on to something here. And he helped me finish editing the book. And that's what we have. So now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and move into, before I talk about the program, I'd like to talk about fitness and nutrition through an evolutionary lens. So I think it's good to understand how our body adapts to our environment and how we're designed as humans if you're going to do something about changing your body composition. So ask the question, why do we get fat? We don't really get fat so much as we store fat. We're hardwired to store fat. It's a survival mechanism, which served our species well for the first several million years through the lean times, the droughts, and the herds moved on and people survived because they were able to store fat. It doesn't work so well in the modern landscape where everywhere you go, they're pushing some kind of refined carbohydrate usually, but some kind of like fast food or manufactured food on you. You go to Home Depot or a gas station or pretty much any retailer and they've got something, a can of Coke or a Snickers bar or whatever it may be. So I think it's rather ironic, actually, that through the first several million years of evolution, what we've evolved to eat is what's most difficult to find, which is like whole intact foods. And what we're perfectly not evolved to eat, which is the most toxic thing out there, is really easy to find, and it's everywhere. So why do we develop and maintain muscle? It's an adaptive response to stress. The stress of exercise, resistance training, just movement is why we develop and maintain muscle. Why do we build and maintain bone density? It's also an adaptive response to the stress of exercise. The lack thereof, stress and exercise, is why we will degenerate bone and muscle mass. It's sort of the use it or lose it principle. If you sit at a desk all day and sit in a chair and type on a keyboard and that's the extent of your exercise, you're naturally going to degenerate, lose bone mass faster than you ordinarily would, and muscle mass as well. Simply, you don't need it. From an evolutionary point of view, muscle mass is expensive to maintain. Expensive in terms of it takes a lot of calories. So our hunter-gatherer ancestors had to work a lot harder if you're going to maintain muscle to go find food. So our bodies are very adaptable. So if you want to trigger that adaptive response, it's through stress of exercise and good nutrition. Strong bones as well. We're going to deteriorate. We naturally deteriorate as we age, but you can slow it down by adding continuous stress over a lifetime, and your bones degenerate at a slower rate. Also, for women, it's a little bit more important, as women are obviously more prone to osteoporosis. So our bodies also adapt to our calorie consumption. We're either in fat storage or fat burning. We're going to seek an energy balance. If you're in calorie surplus, you're going to store fat. If you're in calorie deficit, you're going to burn fat. And that's the pretty simple truth. The point is, our bodies are fine-tuned, efficient machines. We're continuously adapting to our environment, whatever that may be. So through good nutrition and exercise, you can trigger the response that you want. You can repair and maintain muscle. You can maintain bone density. We're better equipped to fight illness, and we look and feel better. Before I get into nutrition, I'm going to talk about calories now. You all know what a calorie is, right? They're little tiny creatures that sneak into your closet at night and sew your clothes a little tighter together. Well, maybe actually, a calorie is just a unit measure of heat. Specifically, it's a unit measure of heat energy. It's the amount of energy required to raise 1 liter of water 1 degree Celsius. So the release of stored energy is measured in calories. Everything that has mass has calories. If you remember E equals MC squared, that's what's really saying energy and mass are equivalent. So anything that has mass, a beef tenderloin steak, a glass of wine, a donut, this podium, they all have everything has calories. You can release the calories through burning. And you can also light your metabolic fire and release the stored energy, which is stored as fat in your body. You're all burning calories right now, just your ordinary body functions. You're breathing, your heart rate, your brain functions, so you can enjoy this entertaining speech. We're all burning calories right now. So either when you consume calories, you're going to burn them as fuel or store them in fat. So I'd like to sort through. There's a lot of misinformation. Calories get talked about a lot, and people write blogs and articles and books about calories. And I view it much like politics. Like unfortunately, the extreme voices and opinions on either side of the market are most heard. Like the loudest voice gets heard, the most extreme opinions. And it's like that on CNN. You hear the extremes of both sides, when in fact, most of the time, the truth is somewhere in the middle and often gets drowned out. So there's a couple ongoing false narratives concerning calories as it relates to nutrition and losing weight. One is that the number of calories just don't matter, that as long as you eat the right foods, presumably the healthy foods, the number of calories don't matter. Well, that clearly is in conflict with the laws of physics. Back to the energy equals MC squared. Energy and mass are equivalent. So if you're in calorie surplus, you're going to store it. If you're in calorie deficit, you're going to burn fat. Our bodies are a closed system. You just can't get around the laws of physics. So the amount of calories you eat does, in fact, matter. Another false narrative is that only calories matter. The theory goes you can eat whatever you want as long as you stay within your calories, and you're going to be fine. Well, different foods have different properties. So I like a good illustration of that would be you could eat. I could construct three different meals of 350 calories: an 8-ounce chicken breast, half a cup of sugar, wouldn't be so good. Or a 5-ounce glass of vodka. You could eat the chicken breast and feel pretty satisfied. You You could eat a half a cup of sugar and you'd probably be bouncing off the walls and have a blood crash an hour later and be asleep on the couch. Or drink the 5 ounces of vodka and who knows, your judgment goes out the window and you're going to have a whole another set of effects. Hopefully people don't do that here. So the source of the calories does, in fact, matter because food, all foods have different properties. So that argument's it's kind of a silly argument, too. So my program's about optimizing your available calories. You're solving for two things. You have to get the right number of calories. If your goal is to lose fat, you should be in calorie deficit. And then eating the right mix of healthy foods. So you're optimizing your calories, which just simply means making the best use of your available calories. The right number and the right mix. So I'd like to talk about calorie tracking. So we know our bodies are always going to find an energy balance. You can do this by counting your calories with a convenient app. There's all sorts of apps available to help you count calories. There's a lot of reasons for counting calories. Accuracy. I can't tell you how many people I've met that are sort of gym regulars and they're very conscious of what they eat, but yet they have another 5, 10, 15 pounds or something that they'd like to weigh, to lose. And they always say, well, I know how many calories I'm getting. And I'll ask them and they'll tell me some number. But after persuading these people to actually start tracking it with an app, everybody's always surprised at how many you're actually getting. And it's always much more than you thought it was. So accuracy. If you use a calorie counting app, you're taking the guesswork out of it. Accountability as well. Once you've committed to a certain number of calories and a certain mix of healthy foods, you're accountable to yourself. And you can log things. It's going to force you to consider every food item. When you start logging food items before you eat it, or even after you've had that snack, you're going to quickly see how you blow out your plan, and just deviating from the plan has severe consequences. So you become accountable to yourself. You also become more dialed in, which is to say you just know your body. After a while, I've been using a calorie counting app for about 3 years now, and I have a very good idea now of the number of calories that I need to lose, say, a pound a week or gain a pound a week. So that's very helpful to get dialed in. You just become more and more in touch with your body and your calorie requirements and food requirements. You also discover correlations, you identify trends. It's sort of like the stock market. You'll see, like, as if you're tracking your weight religiously, your weight might start ticking up around the holidays, and you can look at your food diary and say, okay, if I'm these extra 200-300 calories a day are having this sort of result. So you identify trends. I think the calorie counting app is a very, very useful tool. Allows you to optimize everything you eat. Because you basically only have these two levers. You log calories consumed and the calories you burn. This is a snapshot of, I use MyFitnessPal. It's my favorite app. So a couple of things here to note. You have the total calories. This is my daily goal. I logged my cardio exercise, so it gives me 350 more calories to eat that gets added here. That was originally 2110. The total calories I've eaten, and these are the macronutrients. Protein, carbs, and fat are expressed in grams. I think sodium is milligrams. So there's extremely easy to use. It's a couple of taps on your iPhone. There's 80 million users of MyFitnessPal, and the database is rich. It's a user-loaded database. It's hard to find a food item on the planet that's not in MyFitnessPal. It remembers your personal history, so you can copy previous meals. And just a couple of clicks on your phone, and it works real well. I remember when it was suggested to me about 3 years ago that I use MyFitnessPal, I was kicking and screaming, no, I don't need it. I don't need a calorie counter. I was one of the people saying, I know what I'm eating. But after you start using it, you find out that you really don't know what you're eating. And it's just an extremely useful tool. And I find myself in that same position, persuading friends to give it a try. And most people, after they try, they admit that it's a very useful tool. It's easy to set up. You put in your current weight, your goal weight, some personal details, and there's a built-in algorithm that will tell you if your goal is to lose 1 or 2 pounds a week, it'll tell you exactly how many calories you can use. There's a little bit of a manual setup. I would not use their default profile. You have to put in your own percentages of macronutrients, and I recommend 45% protein, 35% fat, and 20% carbohydrates, and that's a good starting point for anybody that's trying to lose fat and develop lean muscle. So I strongly recommend using, at least give it a try, commit it for a week or two, and use a calorie counting app. I'm going to talk about the Get Fit Lean program now. And again, this is the reverse order of the book. I'm going to start with talking about resistance training. Weight training, weightlifting, they're all synonymous terms. But it's not just pumping iron. Any kind of body weight training is weight training. Push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, portable gadgets like resistance bands and TRX straps, resistance machines, traditional free weights, it's all body weight or weight training, resistance training. I just lump it all into one. Everyone should lift weights. It's really easy, and I don't have to convince guys, especially young guys. Everybody wants chest and arms and shoulders and biceps and look good at the beach, the mirror muscles. But unfortunately, a lot of women need convincing and aren't sold on lifting weights. So I focus a little bit here on trying to persuade the women in the audience to do resistance training, because it can be a hard sell. I think a lot of women have the fear of looking like a guy, of getting too big of muscles. And in reality, ladies, most of you don't have enough testosterone to develop muscles. I've been doing this hard for 30 years, and the muscle growth comes very, very slow. For the rare exceptions, you can tone it down a little bit, but that's an anomaly. So women don't want to become too masculine. But I think, in my humble opinion, it really enhances the female form. Think about it. If you can shape a rounder bottom and shapely legs and tighten your arms and back and tummy, you're really enhancing that traditional hourglass figure. So everybody should lift weights. There's another benefit, too. Lean muscle is the furnace that burns calories. Like I was mentioning before, the calories, from an evolutionary point of view, muscle's expensive because muscle burns calories. So as you develop lean muscle, you're going to burn more calories. You help with your muscle retention. Through the aging process, we all slowly degenerate bone and muscle mass. And more importantly, you're slowing bone density loss. Our bone density peaks around age 25, and that's men and women both. So hopefully you had a good nutrition growing up as a child, because you're going to have a more bone density to start with. And post-25, it's sort of a slow deterioration. And you can't stop this process, but you can slow it down significantly. And the best thing to do is move your body, resistance training, exercise. And like I say, particularly important for women, osteoporosis prevention. So my program's really about, my resistance part of my program is about triggering that adaptive growth response. And I have to say about that, sometimes less is more. Like a big mistake, back to the guys, of people that are over-enthusiastic, like young guys that get in the gym and want to build muscle, is overtraining. They'll spend too much time, it's what I did in my youth, spend too much time lifting weights when really all you have to do is trigger that adaptive response. I spend 10, 15 minutes a day lifting weights. I work each muscle or muscle group once a week. Recovery is most important. Once you put a load on that you're unable to do, you've triggered the adaptive growth response, and that's it. You're really done. You can move on. So it's super. Knowing that makes it very time efficient. It's hard to make an excuse not to do resistance training knowing you've only got to spend 10, 15 minutes a day. So my resistance training principles: muscle isolation, focus on one muscle group, maintain continuous motion. These details are outlined in the book through, there's a lot of exercise illustrations, but not allowing your muscle to rest, and training to failure, which, because there's really no way to measure 100% effort other than pushing to the point where you can no longer move the resistance, whatever it may be. And that's the effectively how you trigger the growth response, is by putting a load on yourself that you're unable to do. Your body responds with an adaptive response. Muscle confusion means mixing it up and doing different routines every week, week over week. And then recovery is most important. And proper nutrition is part of the recovery. Cardio training. The energy balance equation, there's calories in, calories out. This is the calorie burn part of the equation. Get your heart rate up and sweat, move your body, ignite your metabolic fire, and do it frequently. It really doesn't matter what you do. Pick an exercise or a cardio exercise that you like. If you like the bike, swim, Stairmaster. I'm time efficient. I get on the gym in the morning. I catch up on the world news, and I do a stair machine or an elliptical machine or something, watching CNN in the morning. But do something that you like. Move your body. Do something. There's a lot of benefits of doing cardio exercise. One being not only that it strengthens your heart, which is a muscle, your cardiovascular system, your respiratory system is strengthened through cardio, but there's also residual effect of the rest of the day. And this can last up to 24 hours after doing exercise, but your metabolism runs a little higher, and you're going to burn a little more calories, not to mention the release of dopamine, and you're just going to feel better. A positive thing, no matter how bad your day is, if you've done your cardio and you worked up a sweat, you're going to feel good. You've done something positive. So there's a lot of benefits to the calorie burn. Measuring your calories is important too. The MyFitnessPal slide, you saw there was a 350-calorie credit. And there's a lot of wearable tech. Most machines in the gym have the handheld devices that can tell you how many calories you burned. You can get a Fitbit. There's all sorts of devices now that you can accurately measure how many calories you burn. And the benefit and the reason I suggest that doing that is it's going to encourage you, if you're serious about tracking your calories and updating your meal plan every day in MyFitnessPal or whatever app you use, you're going to want to count calories because effectively it's more to eat. We all like to eat. So you get to eat your calories. Nutrition is 80% of the game. You can't out-train a bad diet. No matter what you do in the gym, you can sweat buckets, you can work out like an Olympic athlete, but if you eat the wrong foods, you're not going to make much of a dent in the problem. So it's most important. And the most important point of nutrition, if you take nothing else away from this today, is to stop poisoning yourself with refined carbohydrates. The biggest single culprit is refined carbohydrates, flour and sugar. Refined carbohydrates really means you've stripped away the nutritional content, any nutritional value, and you're just left with an energy value. In the case of flour, they refine grains like wheat, and they remove the husk, the bran, the germ, and all that's left is an energy value. Sugar is made by crushing and boiling sugarcane and beets until only the sucrose remains, which only has an energy content value. These things have zero nutritional value. It's simply energy. And if you don't burn it immediately, you're going to store it. So let me make a clear distinction between good and bad sugar. And remember this phrase, bound in fiber. Fruit has a lot of sugar, and certain root vegetables also have sugar, but that sugar is bound in fiber, which means your body has to work to release the sugar. Whereas added sugar is really pre-digested. It's immediately digested, and it's the effect on your insulin release system. So the real problem with refined carbohydrates, particularly sugar, is the effect on your insulin release system. It wreaks havoc on your insulin release system. As soon as you eat sugar, immediately reaction is your blood sugar is spiked, and this triggers the release of insulin. Insulin is a messenger that tells your fat stores to start storing blood sugar. And usually, if it's a large dose of blood sugar, your liver also starts absorbing in your pancreas, and you store the fat in your belly, which is visceral fat. Funny enough, the subcutaneous fat that you store under your skin is relatively harmless, and we all have a different genetic disposition, but most people store fat in their belly, which is a visceral fat, effectively smothering your internal organs, your liver, your pancreas, and the liver and pancreas actually absorb it as well, and this is toxic, which leads to all sorts of inflammatory diseases, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, hypertension, metabolic syndrome, dementias linked to inflammation of sugar absorption, all of these things. So sugar is the real criminal here. I'd like to talk about processed fats and refined fats to clarify, for my purposes, refined, as I said, was stripping away the nutritional value. Processing could be anything, really. If you cut an apple or grill a chicken breast, you're processing the food. But for the purpose of this, I'll say they're synonymous terms. Processing in the context of what I'm talking about is equivalent to refining. So talk about some of the worst processed foods are manufactured fats and artificial fats and oils. Fats and oils are both lipids, and really it's a molecular class called lipids. And they're effectively the same thing. It's just a fat is a solid at room temperature and oil is not. Solid fats, however, tend to contain more saturated fats and or trans fats and cholesterol, higher in cholesterol. And margarine, Crisco, vegetable oils, nut oils, a lot of these are good examples of the fats that we should not be eating. Vegetable oils, particularly soybean oil, is most prevalent. It's French fries, potato chips, cakes, cookies. These things are high in omega-6 fatty acids, which is pro-inflammatory. Modern humans just are not getting enough omega-3 fatty acids, which is anti-inflammatory. The omega-3 fatty acids come from fish oils and flaxseed oils. It's not a lot of sources, but you can get them. Trans fats are particularly evil, and I think trans fats are on their way to being outlawed everywhere, but it's really a chemical process of hydrogenation of vegetable oil, which it solidifies the oil, and it's great for fast food, like for the purposes of French fries. It's convenient because it adds flavor stability, increases shelf life of cookies and things. It's why trans fats got popular, and hopefully they're just not even going to be available much longer. Animal fats have been demonized for years. It's based on some 1950s science that's been debunked over and over, but it's still prevalent. Butter, lard, egg, yolk, fat, they are high in saturated fats. It was thought that all saturated fats were bad. But we now know that there's good and bad, and there was good and bad cholesterol. But what was thought to be bad cholesterol is there's actually two kinds of cholesterols, and there's a type A and B LDL. One's good, one's bad. The bottom line to the fat story, because it's complicated and people have written books on this subject alone, but stay away from the soybean oil, the artificial fats, vegetable oils, the kind of fats that aren't bad for you, animal fats, particularly fish. And you can counterbalance that too many omega-6s and not enough omega-3 by having a big serving of salmon a couple times a week is probably the best thing you can do. Eat your salmon. Read labels. There's a lot of marketing tricks out there. And this is something that really drives me crazy, the fat-free idea. And it tells us here how – this is a really blurry slide. Only 15 calories from fat. Well, the other, what is it, 155 calories are coming from sugar. So they've taken out the animal fat, which is not bad for you, and replaced it with sugar, which is toxic. Fat-free is a terrible label. Brown bread and wheat bread, it's just a color. It needs to say 100% whole grains. Gluten's a popular phrase. I think it's an indigestible protein found in wheat. It passes harmlessly through your gut. But if you feel you don't need gluten in your diet, don't have it. You don't really need wheat. Be careful with organic. I mean, organic's a great thing. Fruit and vegetables that are organic don't have the pesticides and herbicides, and meats don't have the hormones, the steroids, the antibiotics. But it doesn't change the nutritional profile. The little packets of sugar at Starbucks that say organic cane sugar have exactly the same reaction as non-organic sugar. So organic doesn't in itself mean something's healthy. So what should we be eating? Intact whole foods. That's what our bodies are designed to eat. This obviously requires a little bit of food preparation, but most of your calories should come from lean proteins, healthy fats, and complex carbohydrates. And I only say lean proteins because although animal fat's not bad for you, egg yolks and the fat in red meat is high in calories, and we want to optimize our calories. And there can be better sources of fat in as much as like an avocado. You're getting, not only getting fat, but you're getting micronutrients and you're getting fiber. So try to, although the animal fat's not bad for you, I still recommend limiting it a lot. Whole fruits don't have fruit juice. Whole fruits, the sugar is bound in fiber. Green vegetables, root vegetables, whole grains. There's a lot of great sources of complex carbohydrates. Other healthy fats are cold water, any cold water fish, almonds are good, and of course avocado. A little bit about supplements. There's a whole chapter in my book about supplements. I do recommend like a good vitamin and mineral supplement taken with omega-3s. There's a whole lot of other creatine and protein powders and things like that, and you really don't need it. You can get pretty much everything you need from Whole Foods. With the one exception, there's a 20-30 minute window after intense exercise where a protein drink is actually more bioavailable and your muscles are screaming for recovery. And if you're going to have a protein shake, have it just after your exercise. So once you've adopted the whole food diet and you're off of sugar, there's a whole lot of benefits you're going to notice right away. You're going to avoid the energy highs and lows, the blood sugar spikes and energy crashes, and you're just going to feel better. So once again, the mix of these macronutrients I suggest and recommend everyone to start with are 45% protein, 35% fat, and 20% carbohydrates. And that's something, if you find, I recommend stay on that for a month and see how you feel and what sort of progress you make. And you can always tweak it a little bit and change it to 40, 30, 30. You can play with those numbers a little bit. But part of it, like I mentioned before, is finding out how your body responds and getting in touch with your body. And you can do that through the calorie counting app. In closing, to sum up my program summary here, optimize your calories. Most of your calories should come from whole, intact foods. Avoid sugar. If you avoid sugar and flour and all refined carbohydrates, your nutrition plan is 80% there. Those are the biggest culprits. Put yourself in calorie deficit if your goal is to lose fat. You have to be in calorie deficit. You can't get around the laws of physics. Do your cardio and do it frequently. Get your heart rate up and burn sweat. You need to burn, light your metabolic fire. Do your resistance training. Your trigger the adaptive growth response. It's the only way to develop lean muscle. So commit yourself to my program. You will get fit, lean, and keep your day job. Anybody can do it. Thank you.
I have a question about resistance training to failure for older trainees, and one of the issues that has to be grappled with is connecting tissue and joint instability and lack of blood supply to older joints, and so lifting to failure can sometimes be injury inducing for older people. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm experiencing those things myself. I did significant damage in my younger years playing with steroids because we got really crazy strong too fast. And I have shoulder, lower back, elbow. I've got a lot of problems. And I call it training friendly to your body. And I've restrict my movements. I illustrate in the book a lot of good technique. I mean, you could work with a trainer and experiment, or you could just play with the exercise and find the range of motion. Working with a trainer is good. Work with a spotter. But I've changed my program a lot. I use a lot less. I don't use heavy weights so much. I use higher reps with lower weights. I'm still going to failure, but instead of using 100-pound dumbbells, maybe I'm using 50-pound dumbbells, and I'm doing 30 reps instead of 10 reps. And just restricting the movement and playing with a lot of the body mechanics to find what doesn't hurt. And I'll experiment with really light weights. But I think it's also a fact of life. I agree with you, and it's correct. And it's just, I think, really, your workouts will evolve with age. Mine certainly has. And I'm just learning to train friendly to my body. I hope that helps.
Could you comment on using free weights as opposed to resistance machines?
For most things, I prefer the free weights because I think there's an extra component of balance involved. Like picture dumbbells, you're having the balance. So it's just you're not just fighting gravity alone, but you're trying to balance the joints. I think you generally get more out of it. And a lot of the machines, you're sort of can be dangerous because, like the gentleman pointed out, you're locked into a plane. Like it's oftentimes a curved path or a linear path. And like your shoulder joint is, this ball joint is the most complex joint in your body. It allows the greatest range of motion. So the rotator cuff is easy to tear, minor torn. So and so I can't use machines at all for shoulder exercise because I'm caught in this plane, whereas with free weights, you're allowed to do things more of a natural movement. So I generally would say I prefer free weights, but then you have the component of you want to be safe first and foremost. So having a trainer, having a spotter, or if you're all alone, just using lighter weights and doing more reps. Because, again, you're ultimately trying to trigger the adaptive growth response that I mentioned. And so going to failure is important, but you can achieve that with heavy weight and low reps or low weight and high reps, you can achieve the same thing. In either case, you can still go to failure, and you can do it safely.
Yeah, I've lost about 30 pounds over quite a bit of time. But about 5 months ago, I plateaued. I want to lose another 5 pounds. I can't get it to budge an inch, and I'm low on calories and everything else. Cut my amount of food and everything else down, but I can't get below another. I can't lose another.
It's common, and it's happened to me, and it's something I talk about in the book. It's weight loss and fat loss is never a straight line. It's a step function, and I think our body is, again, we're adaptive, and what you're describing, your body's effectively adapting to the possibility of starvation, right? Like you've cut your calories so much that at some point your body starts clinging to the last available, and I've found the same thing. I've preparing for these shows and things where I've been so incredibly precise, my weight will maintain the exact same weight for a week or 2 weeks sometimes, and then bam, overnight you seem to drop 2 or 3 pounds immediately, and then you're at a new plateau and your body fights back. And I think that's very, very common. And as your weight's lowering, those plateaus just get longer and longer. I would say, you get your body fat percentage measured to just make sure that you're safe and you're not taking it too low. Oh, really? I think the plateau is just longer. I would just say stick with it and try changing the composition of your macronutrient profile as well. Like try the 45, 35, 20, and that can trigger some response as well. It is.
Yes, I wondered if low-fat milk is part of your diet or how you feel about dairy.
Great question. on one hand, from back to the evolutionary point of view, you can like the paleo people, you can make the argument that milk is designed for mammal infants, period. And after you're weaned from your mother, you never need milk again. And in general, I support that notion. And sucrose or lactose is the natural sugar found in milk. We don't have the adults don't have the enzymes to deal with it. We're all to some degree everyone's lactose intolerant. It's sort of like cat allergies. If you pile enough of cats in the room, we're all going to start sneezing at some point. We're all allergic to cat dander, and we're all lactose intolerant given enough of it, right? So the short answer is no. I think particularly if you're in calorie deficit and you're trying to reach a goal, to just cut out the dairy. When I'm in maintenance, so I have to tell you, I love cottage cheese, and I do love milk, but it's very far and few between that I ever have it. I don't recommend it. And a lot of the sugar stuff, they add sugar. The one exception is Greek yogurt. If you look at the nutrition profile of Greek yogurt, it's so high in protein and very, very low in lactose, if almost none. Someone else?
Actually, that was my question. 45% of protein, that's a lot of protein. So what is it that you actually eat?
I have several meal plans in the book. I eat a lot of chicken breast, and I meal prep for the week just because I'm busy, and I'll cook like 6 or 8 chicken breasts, and I'll take them for work. And I've found 1,000 ways to make chicken, and lots of rubs and dry rubs and spices, and as long as – just read the label, make sure there's no sugar in it. But there's plenty of sugar-free spices. You can dice chicken. I grill it, I bake it, I broil it, slow cooker. Egg whites are great. Fish, of course. Occasionally red meat. I love red meat. And if you find it hard, for guys it's usually easier, and women I've worked with tend to find it more difficult to have that much protein. Again, I mean, go 40-30-30 or change it a little bit if you're finding it too difficult. But you'll also find in a calorie-restricted, calorie deficit program that you're not going to have that many calories. And although it sounds like a lot, if you're in calorie deficit, you know, maybe you're going to have 1,600-1,700 calories to work with. So it's not as much as it sounds. I mean, that could be like 4-ounce, 5-ounce serving, you know, 3 times, 4 times a day.
Do you have suggestions for vegetarians?
That's a wide open topic. In defense of vegetarians, the problem is not, there's not a single vegetable on this planet that has a complete protein profile. The 9 essential components of a protein don't, amino acids is the term I'm looking for. There's not a single vegetable that has all 9 essential amino acids. But it can be compiled with the right mix. I mean, one problem with it, I mean, there's a pro bodybuilder who's a vegetarian. Just the quantity that you have to eat to get enough protein and to complete that profile is very, very difficult. But it can be done. I don't recommend. I think we're omnivores, and I think we're perfectly designed to eat meat. So, but if you are a vegetarian, you can pull it off. It's not easy. All right.
What about grains? Do you ever eat grains? Like, speaking of vegetarian, quinoa, which is a really good protein and a you know, profile and a complete grain. Do you ever eat grains yourself?
I do. I eat whole grain bread, like a slice with my eggs. I love whole grain bread. I think it tastes great. It's filling. I don't eat a lot of it. I'm just, I love quinoa and these things. It's part of it's a preparation for me. I'm busy and I just don't have the time for food prep. I like oatmeal. I love oatmeal. Whole, you know, that's a great source.
So what about nuts? You eat nuts and seeds, right? So there's another.
I mean, almonds are great. I mean, and as far as something else I talk about in the book, like healthy snacks, you've got to have healthy food alternatives available to you. I mean, we go to the office, and if you don't, you know, what's the saying about not preparing to fail is not preparing is preparing to fail. have snacks available all the time, like, because you run out of the house and you don't take a lunch or a snack, and then you're trying to put together a healthy meal plan for lunch in the city or wherever you happen to be. Good luck. It's difficult. Like, you can control it by meal prepping and bringing things with you. So almonds, a short answer, have a couple of almonds in your purse all the time. They're great for you.
More questions? Okay, all right, well, I'll give the little final thank you here. Yay. So in closing, our thanks to J.D. Griffin. Don't forget, his book is out there, and it's got all the diagrams for all the exercises in there, too, in the back. So we thank J.D. Griffin for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.